Welcome back to HealthLink on Air, produced each week by Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. Linda Cohen along with you. And joining me again this morning is a regular guest on our show, Dr. Deirdre Nealon, Associate Professor of Bioethics and Humanities and the editor of Upstate's award-winning literary and visual journal, The Healing Muse. Welcome, Deirdre. So nice to see you again.
Thanks, Linda. I love to be here.
I love it when you come in. So each time you come, you join us, you bring some amazing contributions to the journal, and they always give myself and the listeners, I guess, increasing insight into the process of illness, healing, and those who are, you know, both experiencing that and the people who surround them. So what have you brought with you today?
Well, today I thought we might do something a little bit different and focus on three pieces that talk about the illness experience from the point of view of the others who are walking with those people through illness. And we pay a lot of lip service, you know, about, oh, it's good to have a support team, et cetera. But in these pieces, you'll get to hear sometimes the support team isn't giving what we think we need. Sometimes they're unbelievably wonderful. And sometimes it grows out of a work situation that you're just totally surprised and euphoric.
Sounds great. Let's go.
Okay.
What's the first thing you're going to read?
I'm going to read a poem by a woman from Massachusetts. I don't know much about her except that this was her first published piece. Her name is Angela Giles Patel, and the title of her poem is Silence Over Coffee. If instead I told you I had a cancer, would you still sit biding your time, waiting for me to heal? Would life carry on in your view of us as each day my body was divided, conquered, one weakened cell after another? If instead I could show you spots or unnatural shadows on an X-ray film and say, here and here and here, that is where it is. That is where I am slowly dying. Would you still simply pat me on the head and say, now, now? But I can't fix my trembling finger on a single point to tell you this is where it hurts. And it's not my fault I've no black and white image to prove I'm being devoured slowly, painfully being consumed by my dis-ease. And while what you say may be true, that this too shall pass, any remission just means dormancy. I must tell you, the fiercest storms gather strength while resting, and nature's cycles prey on weakness. They are meant to destroy first, and then perhaps rebuild. For now, we both sit quietly sipping our morning coffee, you burdened by my malaise, my disorder, me alone waiting, hoping for relief.
Wow.
Now, that one is very different, Linda, because usually I bring you a poem in which a spouse or a partner is totally supportive. And in this one, the speaker's letting us know that because the illness, which isn't really identified, is not able to be seen on an X-ray, this person feels totally alone within it because the partner or the family member, the caregiver, is simply saying, well, it'll pass. We can get through this.
It's very interesting to me, too, because it almost implied to me, although I can't, I'm pulling something out of here which may not be here, but this notion of it could have been more of a mental
yes
illness, so to speak, and how that's often not given the kind of respect.
Exactly.
There's the stigma almost
yes
attached, and this notion, this too shall pass, almost discounting it.
Exactly. And that was my feeling, too, when we read this poem. I thought to myself, this is a really good poem about depression, perhaps, that kind of constantly eating away at the person, but everybody else around you just keeps saying, well, if you just do something, you'll feel better. And we know that that's not necessarily the case with it.
So. And interesting how it suggests that that there is a great need on the person's part for that kind of, well, support and
yes
acknowledgement and respect
yes
for what they're going
exactly
through.
Exactly. And I like this poem, too, when I teach, you know, in my medical courses with the medical students, you want them as potential care people, professionals, to recognize that it's so much more than simply diagnosing a problem and then perhaps writing a prescription, that you really do need to sit with this person and witness as she or he is talking in here. We're drinking coffee, but it's in silence. You
yeah
don't help me. You know?
It's witness and honor,
yes,
I think,
yes,
is what I'm hearing.
I think so, too.
So what's the next one?
Okay, then we're going to move over to, and again, this is wonderful because this is the first time publication for this writer as well. Her name is Jennifer Heatley, and she's from Central New York. So we met. I met her at a reading a little while ago.
Yeah, local
down in Ithaca. And she has written this poem in memory of a friend of hers that she lost. It's called I Imagine the Poison. And you know that when we talk about chemotherapy, that chemotherapy is a poison in some sense. It does.
It kills the cancer cells, but it kills a lot of other things.
So here her speaker is, I Imagine the Poison. While you were sleeping on the way to chemo that beautiful Friday morning, from the serene and loving quiet circling around us, I realized that the 39-mile drive was only roughly 1/2500th the length of the bloodways of the body. If they were to be unwoven and laid out, they would circle around this spinning gem of a planet 4 times. And so would I walk around this world for a cure. I thought about the lifeblood of you, and while I sat beside you with the new poison pumping, I tried with all my might to imagine that the poison was sunlight, shining through your veins with a warmth that heals to the bone. I imagined the poison was fresh, robust air entering you through the Mediport window in your chest, blowing the cancer cells adrift as if they were simply dust that had gathered on drapes. I imagined the poison was like chicken broth, soup for the soul, glistening and golden with the sweet, fatty innards of love, floating full of the tender care of mothers, grandmothers, daughters, sisters, and ancestors who believed there was nothing that chicken stock could not cure. And I imagined the poison was like the water in Dorothy's bucket and that the cancer cells would shrink and melt like the Wicked Witch of the West. And I imagined the poison was a long lineup of protesters marching, holding flags that said, peace now, make love, not war. In the lineup were veterans who donned welding masks and melted their machine guns into a giant peace sign. I protest this cancer, and I chant to myself, may peace be in this body. Send in the sunlight, air, water, chicken stock, protesters, and peace. I said a silent prayer while we were waiting for the oncologist. I imagined that the poison was seed and soil. May life and landscape begin sprouting up again. May these nesting grounds fill up with birds fledging from the watershed of spirit and hope. May they rise up through the branches of your body and call out with their song of life.
Oh, my goodness.
Is that gorgeous?
Oh, my goodness. That is incredible.
So what I love about this one is that we do talk a lot of times for people who are enduring cancer that it's so important that they visualize positive energy. And there's, you know, a whole theory of thought about thinking about the cancer being attacked by the chemotherapy agent. So the poet, in this sense, has done a wonderful job for us as she sits witnessing. Now, in the other poem, there was also a person sitting witnessing but not giving anything. This person is doing so much with that prayer of making it water, air, sunlight, peace, you know, everything over and over again, trying to hope that we will emerge at the end of this back into life again.
And the idea that the person who's traveling along on that journey, excuse me, with the ill person can really have an impact in some way through that prayer, meditation, hope, energy, force.
You know, I've noticed with the internet, Linda, you know, so many people now have those websites, Caring Bridge or mylifeinfo.com, whatever. You're able now to join with your friend who may be suffering from some illness hundreds, you know, of miles away. People through the internet are doing this same sort of thing, that we will all chant at this hour, we will all say, you know, this kind of prayer, ring a bell, whatever. It's a wonderful connection.
I mean, it's also a way of potentially gaining a sense of control when there is no control.
Exactly.
It's a way of engaging.
Exactly.
In a human sense. I don't want to run out of time, but I want to hear this last piece you brought us.
Okay, so this last one now is a little, it's on the same theme, but a little bit different. We're going to do an essay, a very short essay by Howard Stein. He's from Oklahoma, and he tells us this story called Hair. Helen, one of our clinic nurses, had one head of hair. It was thick. It was wavy, it was bushy. It was everything that my balding head was no longer. Helen had been a nurse here as far back as I can remember. Her memory of everything was a vital skill upon which we heavily relied. She knew people, medications, phone numbers, what worked and what didn't. She was a presence as well as a role. While not exactly charismatic, she was always pleasant, even cheerful, eager to get the job done and then some. She was a quiet leader. Out of the blue, her doctor discovered breast cancer in her. Helen soon had surgery and then a regimen of chemotherapy. All the splendid hair on her head fell out. When she returned to the clinic, Helen began wearing hats to work, always tasteful, but her head was always covered. Within only a few days, everyone who worked in the clinic showed up with coverings on their heads, dressy hats, corny hats, headscarves, and of course, since this is Oklahoma, baseball caps, with the bill facing forward. Head covering became the new standard rather than the exception. When I asked, no one could remember exactly who came up with the idea. It was as if everyone thought of it simultaneously. The hats stayed on for weeks, until Helen ceased to feel that her head was naked in the sight of everyone. Only when her hat came off did others bare their heads. No one had words for it until I asked. Certainly no one talked of social solidarity. They just put on hats as if it were the obviously right thing to do under the circumstances. Her coworkers did not want her to be or feel alone, to feel different, embarrassed, to feel like a freak. Most of the time, it's an individual who blends in with the group. This time it was the group who enveloped Helen, in themselves becoming in the process like her. She, in turn, was no different from them. Helen is back to work, full time, with a full, thick, wavy, bushy head of hair. So this one, what I loved about it was, at work, we have friends. I mean, we're friendly with the people that we work with, but not always do we have a fabulous relationship. And as the writer tells us here, Helen's not particularly charismatic. She's not the person that you might think first off of, this is our person in the office. She was a leader, a quiet leader. And when the unthinkable happened to her, the loss of the hair, I just loved how, almost instinctively, the workplace figured out a way to bear witness with her, to
and
walk
to show
in solidarity,
respect.
And
yeah.
to show respect.
Well, I mean, I think it says all three of these pieces say so much then about what you said initially was it's the environment in which someone with illness finds themselves really has a great impact.
It does. It does, Linda, because, you know, you're hit twice. The first is you're hit with the news of your illness. The second is, how am I going to be now? I'm going to be different. And what you just said is right on. How those people around you help you or hurt you is the rest of the story that you're going to tell.
And it sounds to me like in each case, obviously, you have the inner circles, and then you have, in this case, this last piece, kind of an outer circle.
Yes.
But this notion of social solidarity
yeah.
is a really powerful one.
Yeah.
And I think it also says a lot that this particular place was a unique workplace, I think. Maybe a healthcare setting, in a sense, because she was a nurse,
yes.
suggests that maybe people were more sensitive to the entire experience.
I'd always like to think that that's true, that those of us who are working in this situation are very, very sensitive, but I'm not always sure that's the case.
Sometimes it's the reverse, unfortunately.
Right, unfortunately.
Well, these are wonderful pieces, and they offer so much to people. I would imagine people who have illness or people who work in healthcare, but I think to all of us, there's a humanity to it all. So thanks again for sharing those works with me. My guest has been Dr. Deirdre Neal, an associate professor of bioethics and humanities and the editor of Upstate's award-winning literary and visual journal, The Healing Muse. We'll be right back with more HealthLink on Air right after this short break.